Hello again, I'm John Schrader, and welcome to Watch the Media. This is part two of my conversation with journalist Karim Zidane. Karim Zidane is a sports investigative journalist. His newsletter is called Sports Politica. That's with a K in it. You can Google it and find him. He's written in the New York Times, The Guardian, and other places. You wrote the other day, did you not, that I always wanted to write for the New York Times and basically finally got to write for the New York Times, and then they disband their sports department. So what are your thoughts about that? And really, in the bigger picture, what does it say about sports journalism that an enterprise like the New York Times decides that it no longer needs a sports department? Now, let's not be naive about this. They own The Athletic, and that's where their sports coverage is going to come from. So it isn't as if they just woke up one day and said, yeah, we're not going to do sports anymore at the New York Times. Those other guys are going to do it. But what does it say, do you think?
I want to take this step by step. So I'm going to answer the first part of your question first. Yes, I have always wanted to write for the New York Times. I mean, I grew up as an avid reader, and I really enjoyed reading. And one of the things that I had access to both in Bahrain and Egypt was occasionally copies of the New York Times. And I was always amazed at how much I enjoyed reading the articles in there. Always well-crafted. And the sports section was always so well-crafted as well. The writing was phenomenal. And honestly, you could list a journalist here or there, but really there was just such a wide range of things I wanted to read about. They could make me want to read about, and I'm sorry for anybody who is a baseball fan, but baseball, I've never enjoyed the game, but I can read about it thanks to the New York Times. That's kind of what they were able to achieve. And for me, as someone who was always an avid reader first, it is how I like to experience things. The written word was to me, I like to be able to use my imagination thereafter. It's far more powerful to me than, say, watching a movie to get the story. I much rather read. So the New York Times had a very special place in my heart. And as I knew I was entering sort of this world, always at the back of my mind, I knew this is the ultimate goal for me. I want to be good enough to write there at the New York Times. And over the years, I started developing my resume and building out sort of the place I got to write for. I mean, I got to do that HBO Real Sports documentary, got to go write at, you know, Foreign Policy, Vice, the list goes on. And then I became a columnist at The Guardian. So I was, you know, building my reputation very slowly. And at one point, one of the New York Times actually is sports editors reached out to me and said, hey, I actually really like your work. I don't even like MMA. And I think you've got such an eye for good, like, investigative journalism. You should really think about pitching us sometime. And that took me by surprise. I never would have considered that, A, they would be even following my work or recognizing that I existed to begin with, and B, that they'd even look for a freelance pitch for me. So I sat there for a while. I remember going to my wife and being like, oh my God, the New York Times might want something for me. This has to be the best pitch ever. I remember I was so excited. And I did. I worked on this pitch, and it was a story that actually we ended up not writing. I ended up moving on to a very different story entirely. But it was actually a story about what we were just talking about, which is sort of this intersection of the far right and mixed martial arts, and sort of the rise of extremism in combat sports in the United States in particular. So that was the pitch. It was accepted, and I thought, this is unbelievable. I'm going to write for the New York Times. We ended up instead working on a couple of Kadyrov stories because they were really interested in my Kadyrov stuff. And I built relationships with editors like, you know, Oscar Garcia and Andrew Dass, these really, really sharp, intelligent human beings who were also generous with their time and generous with their guidance and support and feedback, legitimately wanted to see you produce the best thing you could. And they put in that effort, like Oscar and Andrew, these are people who would call you and check in. Here is this. Here's what the latest round of edits looks like. Here's what we're going to do with this. Here, I want you to actually go ask this person this again. How about we go do this? How about we rethink of it this way? It meant more work. It was harder work working with them than the vast majority of other places I've worked for. The editorial process was stringent, was complicated, was it sometimes made me want to tear my hair out. That's how much it pissed me off. But it was essential, and I'm so thankful for it. And it was something I had never experienced before. So the more I kept working with them, the more I saw this pathway for myself to eventually become a full-time journalist with them. And I actually wanted to. I thought to myself, well, if I'm producing these stories that I'm really happy with, and I feel like I'm being given the resources finally that I've long felt I've deserved in the space, and just the recognition and the appreciation, especially as a freelancer. So if they're treating me this well as a freelancer, then all I was thinking at the time was, you know, it must be great to be on staff. Of course, that's not necessarily a one-to-one thing. And on every side, I'm clearly looking at this as a grass is greener issue, but this is how, at least I'm taking you through sort of my headspace at the time. Then I finally arrived to them a few months ago with what is one of the biggest scoops of my career. And it was a big scoop for them as well, which is I had acquired Leo Messi's tourism contract with Saudi Arabia. And we were able to review it. We went through the extremely difficult process of fact-checking and sourcing everything. And it ended up getting published for the New York Times, and it made the front page. And it was really here that I thought to myself, if I can make the front page of the New York Times on a sports story like this, then I must be close. Less than 2 weeks later, they shut down the sports desk. So I didn't even get to sort of live off that high for too long, because we were already talking about follow-up stories. And I had these ideas for all the stories I'm going to get done there before the end of the year to continue, you know, building myself up and building on that momentum. And then it felt like the rug was pulled out from under me. And I understand I'm the freelancer. There's 35 people there with full-time jobs who've gotten far worse right now. And I feel for all of them, especially like the ones that I got to know. These were wonderful people who love the job that they're doing and were really interested in doing it the best way they could. The idea that another place is just going to up and replace the New York Times, I don't buy it, because based on what I've seen, I've worked with a lot of outlets, and I've worked almost with more outlets that have gone under than continue to exist. And I have never gone through such an editorial process as what we did at the New York Times. And so for some people, it might think it's ridiculous because they've seen sort of the questionable things that show up in the New York Times as, say, op-ed section. But let me just tell you, when it came to the investigative work and the real journalism that we were doing in the sports section, No. That went through all the editorial processes that it needed to. And I'm very proud of the work that was produced. And not everybody's going to be able to do that. The Athletic, which you just mentioned, that The Athletic is going to be replacing the New York Times' sports coverage after they disbanded the sports desk. The Athletic works very differently to The Times. What The Times was able to do in the last few years was give you the story behind the story. It wasn't necessarily going to give you the scores or whatnot or talk or even profiles of individual players for the most part. But even when they do that just a little bit better than other places. Like Rory Smith is just extraordinary. He just did a profile of Sam Kerr, the most impactful women's soccer player in the world, who's leading the Australian team right now. And it was just so beautifully written. And he's doing that under the pressure of knowing that he might not have a job in a few months. And he's still producing work like that.
Yeah.
The Athletic does do great work, but they're a team-focused entity. They write long forms in a different way. They approach the process very differently to The Times does. Yeah. There should be a space for both. But right now, what it looks like to me is that the New York Times is replacing its unionized workers with non-union staff.
Yeah.
And that's just horrific behavior, especially from an organization that's doing extremely well. It's doing extremely well. They should not be doing something like this. The idea that they're going to move 35 journalists and editors around, sort of just give them these other jobs, makes me think of, based on how other companies have handled it, that they'd eventually get laid off, or, you know, they just want to do it quieter than they would by sort of firing 35 people in one go. It doesn't look good. That's the cynical side of me saying this. And just for sports journalism, there were already so few spaces that offered you the resources and the time and the patience to write really good journalism. It's hard.
Yeah.
People think you can just, but that's why I call myself a columnist for The Guardian, because I can produce a piece in a day or two, but it's not going to be investigative. It's not going to be heavily sourced or researched. A column is a column at the end of the day. It's a thought process just going in about what's going on in front of you. It's not the same as doing the actual journalism. And at some point, where is that going to go? Who's going to do that?
And at a time now, and I don't know if ironic is the right word, but incidentally, at a time now when the sports business worldwide has never seen more money, more attention, more globalization. Of course, you know, it's been going on for a long time, but It's at a time when the sports business itself has never been richer. And I don't mean that just financially, but it's never been richer and deeper and more layered and more in need of inspection. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think right now we're talking, just me and my coverage of sports and politics. In 2015, people would give me the side eye all the time, as in like, what are you even talking about, sports and politics thing? Like, is this really a intersection? And now, if I just mention, you know, my niche is sports and politics, people have tons to talk about off the top of their heads. And it's not just like referencing the obvious ones like Beijing and Qatar 2022 World Cup, but they want to talk about everything. They want to talk about Saudi buying out, you know, the hostile takeover of the PGA Tour. They want to talk about Saudi's investment in the Pro League and all these football players that are being bought out. They want to talk about Messi going to the United States instead of Saudi Arabia. Like, Saudi Arabia is looming on the world stage right now, and people are taking notice. And who's going to be left to really write about stuff like that? It's not just about someone like me, because the New York Times had a bunch of reporters who were doing this kind of work. They had Kevin Draper, they had Tarek Pena. These were exceptional journalists, and they remain obviously exceptional journalists. I don't know why I phrased that in the past tense, but Tarek really focused on the coverage of the International Olympic Committee and FIFA, which are two mafias and two extraordinarily powerful mafias in this world right now. And if they are allowed to continue having the type of autonomy they have in sports, and by that I mean autonomy in the sense that there's no accountability and no transparency whatsoever in how they do anything, we are doomed. It doesn't matter how rich the sports gets, that will never trickle down enough in a way that it can create a diverse landscape and actually better these sports. What drives me crazy about fans sometimes is just like, you're a party pooper, why are you talking about it? Why do you even cover this if you hate it so much? What I don't understand about people sometimes is, how can you turn the other cheek and claim you still love the sport? If you love these sports, and why are you watching them get like poured out entirely, like completely rotted out from the inside, and just sitting like it's treating it like it's just another day in the office? It's disappointing, it's disheartening in many ways, and I'm not quite sure where we go from here.
Kareem Zidane is an investigative sports journalist. His newsletter called Sports Politica, it's at the intersection of sports and politics, as we have been discussing for some time now. And as a professional, he's provided me with a perfect segue into further conversation about Lionel Messi, who is now a member of Inter Miami in Major League Soccer. His base salary somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 million a year, but he gets a cut of Apple. He gets a cut of Adidas, a brilliantly conceived contract, it would seem. So that while he helps the game grow here, he gets financially rewarded for it. And I don't think anybody probably would blame him for that. As it pertains to this conversation, he turned down reportedly more than $1 billion from Saudi Arabia. Ronaldo did not turn it down. Benzema did not turn it down. A number of golfers did not turn it down. So what does that say then, as we move into this conversation about sports washing and what responsibilities the athletes have for their own image, their own legacy, and for what kind of accountability do they have to and for the people who pay them? I know there's a lot in there, but I know what you know what I mean.
Oh, I absolutely do. I'd like to start this off with saying the context is interesting for Leo Messi. I think, just as you mentioned, the cut of Apple and the fact that he gets to shape the future of and the future landscape of the MLS and soccer in the United States, I think was one of the primary reasons he ended up taking this decision. Messi is a big picture legacy person, right? And he, at this point, has secured pretty much everything he could. You'd think that he could have retired a happy man after that World Cup and never had to do anything again. If there was something that was going to get him out of bed, it was this idea that how can I continue to distinguish myself from my arch rival, Ronaldo, and what else is there left for me to do? Well, Ronaldo is the one who went to Saudi, opened up that market, likes to claim he opened up that market. Money opened up that market, as far as I'm concerned. But so Messi going there wouldn't have been as dramatic as the decision that he took to go to the MLS. I think he has the opportunity here to really ingratiate himself to a whole new fan base that might not necessarily have really thought too hard about Leo Messi in the past. Like, he could really change the image of soccer and football in the United States entirely. And that's something that's interesting to him. It's also, I think, interesting that he claims, of course, this was part of the statement, was that his family didn't particularly want to live in Saudi Arabia, or that they preferred living in the United States. I think the way he phrased it. And that really is an interesting segue to this other point, which is Saudi sometimes, you know, you can have all the money you want, you can offer all sorts of things, but at the end of the day, you can't be everything for everybody at once. So for someone like Karim Benzema, for instance, one of the reasons he claimed he was going, I did write an article about this, was because he was a Muslim and he's a proud Muslim and he, you know, wants to, for a change, live in an Islamic country. I can sympathize with that, especially him being an Algerian in France, etc. A very tense situation for Muslims and for Algerians in many ways in a place like France. So I can understand someone wanting to get a very different environment. But he positioned himself and he positions this idea as if that's the main reason he's going to Saudi Arabia, not the obscene amount of money he's actually making to go to Saudi. So, of course, this plays really well with, of course, the Saudi fan base and the Saudi crowd and his Muslim diaspora fans in general. The fact that he's presenting himself as this good Muslim is something that they will celebrate. So, yeah, it's very good PR for him in many ways. So he's even been able to take this change in his career, the Ballon d'Or winner, the current Ballon d'Or winner, technically then the current best football player in the world, has gone to Saudi Arabia. Yet he's presenting it as, oh, you know what, I'm Muslim and it's time for us to, you know, identify ourselves and stake our claim in our own futures in different places. And it's working with some people. That's how different these stories are in context. Both of them are thinking about legacy and both of them have taken the PR direction that they think are best for their careers. It becomes a little more complicated with, I'll use another athlete who is really in the conversation right now, the Liverpool team captain, Jordan Henderson.
Yeah,
exactly. He right now has disappointed a lot of his fan base for his decision to take what is also an obscene amount of money, £700 a week, something in the range of $30 million a year, to go play for Al Ittifaq in Saudi Arabia. Not even one of the four big teams, but Al Ittifaq, which is where Steven Gerrard is coaching right now. And they believe the deal is going to be finalized. And this has really upset people because Jordan Henderson really presented himself as a voice for causes such as LGBTQ plus rights. He really was very outspoken in his support for those communities and really made human rights a crux of his identity as a footballer. And now, well, I mean, anybody, it's hard to deny anybody the opportunity to make more money. Even though he was already a very, very rich man, this is transformational money. Generational wealth is what he's looking at right now. I understand that, but we're going to have to start to accept that when it comes to athletes, what you say versus what you do are very different things. And it's going to be very hard to really trust that any athlete is sincere really about stuff like this in the future. When it's so easy when you're in the UK, where it's the big trend at the time, to talk about LGBTQ plus rights. It costs you nothing. It hurts you in no way. As a matter of fact, it makes you more popular with a lot of people. It hurts you in no way. That is easy activism. That's barely activism. That's making a statement. That's good PR. The activism and the advocacy comes when there is a consequence, when your actions could potentially impact you or harm you in some way. Yet you took that stand anyway because it mattered. He has done none of that. When it actually mattered, he instead chose to take the money and will say, well, my family, my future. In essence, absolutely shattering his legacy, which would have been extraordinary. And he's been one of the most celebrated players in England for a very long time, mainly because of just all these, just, you know, being a class athlete and a class representative on the pitch and off the pitch. And now he does this and goes to Saudi and just completely tarnishes his legacy. It's very disappointing to see, and it goes to show you just how this lack of accountability that we're facing and just this approach to activism that really doesn't matter very much, unfortunately. And you've got these non-disclosure agreements that Saudi Arabia is placing in its contracts. I mean, I saw it with my own eyes in Messi's tourism contract. He cannot say anything that tarnishes Saudi Arabia. The PGA and Saudi's public investment fund, when they reached a framework agreement over the merger, it included a non-disparagement clause in it that was only added in the third revision. So when people say, oh, this is a standard process, no, it's not. It is absolutely not standard process. It was added by the Saudi party in the third round of edits. You can see all those different versions of the contract, and I have. You must expect, though we can't prove it at this moment, that there's going to be more of these no tarnish and non-disparagement clauses across athletes and sports organizations. So the more people that side with Saudi, that start to happily participate in this political project taking place in Saudi, the more entities and the more athletes that are going to be muzzled long term, and just simply by money.
So we're talking about what has now famously become known as sports washing. The Saudis didn't invent it, but they certainly have taken it to new extremes with Formula One, with golf, with I guess tennis is coming. I mean, pick a sport. They would love to buy into the NFL, I'm sure. They would love to buy into other American properties. So let me ask the question this way, Kareem. One of the great American values, I would argue that maybe for many people, the greatest American value is capitalism. It's free market. It's an ability to make money. It's make gobs of money. If indeed it is the greatest value for some, then why should athletes have any kind of responsibility to right and wrong, any responsibility to anything other than themselves and their own wealth?
Well, it's a bit of a paradox, actually, John, because this is an issue facing the United States, absolutely. And many athletes will tell you, I'm sorry, but my family, the money, that's the most important thing in my career. And for a lot of athletes, depending on the sport, context really matters here. Some of the PGA players, we're always thinking of, you know, Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy, and these people who are unbelievably wealthy and make most of their money off sponsorships and ads and stuff like that anyway. But what about, you know, the bottom feeders and the very bottom of that group, that some of these people end up taking these these LIV Golf opportunities because it had a bit more guaranteed money. They had more options to make money in the situation. They're just trying to fulfill the best trajectory they can for their professional careers. And it's hard to fault them in these situations. I found similar sympathy with UFC fighters, some of whom are extraordinarily underpaid, considering the amount of damage and brain damage, et cetera, that they take. I mean, UFC fighters make something like 13 to 17% of overall revenue out of the UFC, which is just horrific, really, in comparison to other sports. So when these fighters would end up flying to Chechnya and taking pictures with Ramzan Kadyrov, I was able to have the nuance to think of it in that, well, this is not great. This is a terrible look for these fighters. It's a terrible look for the UFC. But also, the fighter probably made more in 5 seconds and a smile with Ramzan Kadyrov than they've made in their entire career fighting. And that says more about the organizations themselves and in the end as it does about the athletes. And this is going to apply everywhere. The NBA, the NFL, all these entities are really showing their greed in many different ways. Let's use the NBA as a quick example. The NBA decided that, okay, we're going to allow sovereign wealth funds to buy minority stakes in our clubs and in our teams. Why? Why did you have to do that? Is it because, you know, the valuations just keep going up and up and up and you're looking for new owners and owners who actually have that money and you're running out of billionaires in the United States with enough money to buy a team? Isn't that problematic in and of itself right there?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with entities such as the UFC. It's such a looking for the best TV deals they can, instead of even focusing on putting on the best events that they can, selling tickets and doing it the old way, pay-per-view style. They're setting up these relationships with ESPN that completely separate themselves from athletes entirely. Saudi Arabia is going to be offering groups the same kind of opportunity. You can now instead of having to do it the hard way and, you know, we'll get this, sell tickets, etc., we will give you guaranteed sums of money to come hold your event here, where we are. This is what Saudi Arabia does with the WWE. The WWE holds two events a year in Saudi Arabia. They make more money doing those two events than all their other events combined, all of them. And that's why they do whatever Saudi wants in those events. Saudi wants a little, you know, PR spin on this topic. Sure, we'll do it. They want a propaganda video here. They'll do it. They want to bring out Saudi wrestlers to beat up on Irani wrestlers to make this whole weird geopolitical statement. Oh, we'll happily do that as well. So you find that you end up in this position where organizations and their chase and this endless pursuit for profit end up prostituting themselves to these authoritarian regimes, because you reach a point where nobody else can afford you. And none of that really trickles down to the athletes. So it's hard to really blame athletes trying to survive these situations.
Yeah. And the difference here, it seems to me, is pretty simple, but complicated, right? The Saudis and others who've done this, they're not the only sovereign states that use their funds to invest in sports. But generally, when you start an enterprise, you want to make enough money to be profitable. So you generate revenue and you're profitable and you keep your expenses down. And the Saudis have taken that out of the mix. There's absolutely no way that Saudi football, Saudi soccer can be profitable if you're paying Benzema $200 million a year and you're paying Ronaldo $300 million and Henderson $100 million, whatever it is. It's not a profitable enterprise. So they've taken that completely out of the equation, haven't they?
They absolutely have. So the rules of capitalism are out of the window. You've got the US trying to compete in this capitalist landscape that they understand, competing against an opponent with a bottomless pit of money right now. It's an absolute bottomless pit of money. The approach is so different, which is why you came to the situation that you had at the PGA LIV Golf. People keep calling it a merger. What it was a hostile takeover. The PGA simply had no choice here. The PGA had its players poached from them. Some of its top players, with others that they were on hands and knees begging not to leave. And they were just like drowning in litigation that included antitrust litigation as well, which would have been disastrous for something like the PGA, just like it's problematic for an entity like the UFC. These clear monopolistic entities, right? So you come to a point where you realize, okay, well, they've completely swayed our stakeholders right now. We have no choice but to come to some sort of agreement or they'll drown us. They will completely kill us off. And you're starting to hear similar statements across other sports right now. You're hearing this in tennis, in the world of tennis. You even had Billie Jean King, an idol in human rights, talking about how we should probably hear Saudi out and what's the good of not engaging. It's this newfound fear, and it's a capitalist fear now, that even with your pursuit of profit and just your ability to always find a way, you cannot compete with what these authoritarian governments have. You simply cannot. And that's terrifying in that sense.
And I think, the NFL has famously said that they do not, that their policy does not allow for sovereign funds. But the NBA, Major League Baseball, Major League Soccer, go down the list. Just as we're having this conversation, the British Open is going on. The people who run the Royal and Ancient said, sure, we'd listen to that. The British Open offers the least amount of money. It's still a lot, but the least amount of prize money of any of the four Grand Slam events. So they certainly are going to listen to it. So I think this tide will overwhelm, right? This is a tsunami. This is not just a little tide that's coming up on the beach. This is a tsunami that's going to overwhelm all the industries, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And it will water down a lot of industries. It will leave us with a handful of teams at the very top that can actually afford to compete, including if we think of just simply something like the PGA, you're already running out of it's really not really a competitive league in the way it could be. You're running out of the year where Leicester City could win the Premier League. Those, we're never going to see much of that ever again, because all we have right now are teams that are either funded by you know, state projects and authoritarian regimes, or teams funded by venture capitalists. That's all we have now, and that's not sustainable. It's not sustainable, and it's not in any way how sports were supposed to be. When you think of these football teams and how they were supposed to be fan and community owned, representing a community and the views and mentality of that community and its history, that's all gone. Think of the United Arab Emirates just buying out swaths of Manchester just to turn it into real estate. It was like expensive real estate, and they're going to be profiting off that for years and years to come. Just like the UAE bought, literally leased Chicago's its parking meters for 100 years or something crazy like that. They've already made their profit back on that $1 billion-plus deal with 67 years to spare. So something like the United Arab Emirates is just buying up land everywhere. And I say this from the experience of watching them do this to Egypt, and watching Saudi do this to Egypt as well. What is being done to Egypt, a country that right now has no economic power, a country where it's in a true debt crisis due to the IMF and due to the loans that have been taken by a ridiculous dictator of a leader, that country is being bought out because it has no choice. The United States, on the other hand, has all the choices in the world and regulation at its disposal, is using none of it, and it seems to be enjoying the fact that it's being bought out. And fans are celebrating like this is exactly how the world's supposed to be. We live in some sort of upside down space right now. I'm not sure what simulation we're in, but I'm done with it.
What difference is it that the Emirates or Saudi Arabia or others use sports to wash whatever kinds of human rights abuses and LGBTQ abuses or policies or whatever? What's the difference? Help us understand the NBA being such a deep financial partner in China and not allowing their folks to be critical of China. What's the difference?
I think in all these situations, there's an attempt to control narratives. I think sports washing is a bit of a crude term because it limits us to this idea that all these authoritarian regimes, what they're really interested in is reputation laundering. And I have to be very honest with you here. I don't think most of them give a damn what the West thinks about them. Truly, I don't think Saudi Arabia could care less. And we're seeing right now from its foreign policy, from its demands of the United States, from all sorts of things, that it could not care less what the United States thinks of it. And people have to be really, really understand this right now. The Saudi Arabia is in this for regional superiority, global presence, prestige, and sort of that kind of diplomacy and soft power approach. And they're aiming, their main target is Asia. They are building a new world structure. We've seen that right now. And this is not talking world, new world order stuff or anything like that, but they really are building new alliances in this world, alliances that are completely cutting out Europe and the United States. And we're seeing that with, for just quick example, Saudi Arabia coming to a deal with Iran, its arch rival, with China being the mediator. This completely changes my perception. It should change everybody's perception about what Saudi's truly after. You can see from the events that they're hosting that they're primarily targeting the Asian markets right now. Their investment between them and the United Arab Emirates in their investment in something like cricket, which is really promotes sort of this relationship with India, one of the biggest economies in the world. These are their targets, not the United States. Everybody's thinking of this as, well, I know Mohammed bin Salman killed Khashoggi or whatever, or the Saudis did that. They're not sports washing anything with me. Well, you're not the target. You're not the target. Americans need to come to this world where they understand that their exceptionalism doesn't count that much anymore. America's losing power on a world stage, and most of the world doesn't care what Americans think about them. I speak from the experience of being an Egyptian, walking the streets of Egypt and knowing not a single Egyptian gives a single thought of what's happening in the United States or what they think about them anymore. It's just not the US's place. The United Arab Emirates is doing a very similar thing, but is smarter than Saudi because they've been able to sort of keep themselves off the radar for a while. So they don't have the reputation laundering to achieve in the first place that Saudi needed to. They, on the other hand, are just on this incredible mission of soft power. They've got soft power councils determining how the United Arab Emirates can best spread its national brand internationally. One of those things was Manchester City. The way it has handled Manchester City is very different to, say, how Saudi's handling its sports investments. The United Arab Emirates, and particularly Sheikh Mansour, presented himself as this sort of benevolent leader who's going to invest in this wonderful community and city and give back to Manchester and make it the best place it can be. And people really bought into that, to the point that politicians absolutely welcomed these people in. They welcomed and said, here, come buy up all this real estate. There's been reports coming out now showing that the land was clearly sold well below the prices it should have been sold, and that United Kingdom is the only country that comes out losing in this situation, not the United Arab Emirates. Qatar had a very different situation than both the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. Qatar was a very tiny country with really no significance in the region, very different political agenda than Saudi and the United Arab Emirates, was not very happy with their regional dominance in the region, and came to manage to host this World Cup, or at least got the managed to win the rights to hosting the World Cup. And over the next few years, people actually discovered what Qatar was. Qatar had a whole different mission, which is trying to get people to even recognize that they existed. And that definitely succeeded. And in the meantime, Qatar had this whole political agenda, which included, you know, harboring Islamists from the Muslim Brotherhood from Egypt, from Turkey, from all these different places, really getting on the wrong end of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They ended up in this blockade, and Qatar looked like it was in real trouble for a few years, like this complete blockade of in the Gulf region. But because they held steady and ended up continuing to hold this World Cup event, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, knowing that there was money that was going to be lost on tourism, on flights, on all sorts of things, came to an agreement with Qatar. Qatar now holds a place on the world stage. Whether that continues to take place in the future will depend on how Qatar plays its hand moving forward. But each country has a different reason for wanting to use sports. And this can apply to really any authoritarian regime. We can talk about Rwanda as well. We can talk about China. All these, but China absolutely, China's got this very Saudi effect to it, where they are very much interested in controlling the narrative. Just like Saudi is using its non-disparagement clauses, China uses its absolute leverage, its economic leverage of being able to tell the NBA, well, you're not going to listen to us, we're just going to shut you down. And the NBA will feel that. That's a blow they will feel. And Saudi Arabia can do the same thing. They do it with oil. They've got to do it with oil.
China does it with people. They apparently have as many basketball fans, as many NBA fans in China as there are in the entire United States of America. Yeah. And that's only like 20% of the population. So. Mm-hmm. Well, we could continue this conversation. Reputation laundering, soft power, sports washing. These are all things that we need to be aware of. And maybe we'll dig deeper into those things the next time we get a chance to chat. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. And I look forward to coming back and picking up where we left off, John.
Great. Thank you. Karim Zidane's newsletter on Substack is called Sports Politica, Politika. He's written for The New York Times, The Guardian, and he is a sports investigative journalist and has helped us try and understand a whole lot of stuff that's going on around the world. And we didn't mention once about balls and strikes, about three-point shots. We did talk about football. Pronounced soccer. So thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. You can hear all of our conversations here in podcast form. We carry many of them on our campus radio station at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications. That's KRNU 90.3 FM. Follow me on Twitter at SchraderUNL, on Threads at John Schrader. That's SHRADER. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.